I said nothing.
There's an expression. People ask, why do bad things happen to good people? But in my husband's case, bad things are happening to a bad person. Ironic, isn't it? But they are bad things.
Who does Duke belong to?
My husband. But Duke's as bad as Paulie, in his way. I wouldn't care to choose between them. He was a corrupt cop and a corrupt federal agent and a killer. He's been in prison.
Is he the only one?
On my husband's payroll? Well, he had the two bodyguards. They were his. Or they were provided for him, anyway. But they were killed, of course, outside Richard's College, by the men from Connecticut. So yes, Duke's the only one now. Apart from the mechanic, of course, but he's just a technician.
How many has the other guy got?
I'm not sure. They seem to come and go. What exactly are they importing?
She looked away.
If you're not a government man, then I guess you wouldn't be interested.
I followed her gaze toward the distant trees. Think, Reacher. This could be an elaborate con game designed to flush me out. They could all be in it together. His gate man's hand on his wife's breast would be a small price for Beck to pay for some crucial information. And I believed in elaborate con games. I had to. I was riding one myself. I'm not a government man.
Then I'm disappointed.
I put the car in drive, held my foot on the brake. Where to?
Do you think I care where the hell we go?
You want to get some coffee?
Coffee? Sure. Go south. Let's stay well away from Portland today.
I made the turn south onto Route 1, about a mile short of I-95. It was a pleasant old road, like roads used to be. We passed through a place called Old Orchard Beach. It had neat brick sidewalks and Victorian streetlights. There were signs pointing left to a beach. There were faded French flags. I guessed Quebec Canadians had vacationed there before cheap airfares to Florida and the Caribbean had changed their preferences.
Why were you out last night?
Elizabeth Beck asked me. I said nothing.
You can't deny it. Did you think I hadn't seen you?
You didn't react.
I was in Paulie mode. I've trained myself not to react.
I said nothing.
Your room was locked.
I climbed out the window. I don't like to be locked in.
What did you do then?
I took a stroll, like I thought you were doing.
Then you climbed back in?
I nodded, said nothing.
The wall is your big problem. There are the lights and the razor wire, obviously. But there are sensors, too, in the ground. Paulie would hear you from 30 yards away.
I was just getting some air.
No sensors under the driveway. They couldn't make them work under the blacktop. But there's a camera on the lodge, and there's a motion alarm on the gate itself. Do you know what an NSV is?
Soviet tank turret machine gun?
Paulie's got one. He keeps it by the side door. He's been told to use it if he hears the motion alarm.
I breathed in, and then I breathed out. An NSV is more than 5 feet long and weighs more than 55 pounds. It uses cartridges 4.5 inches long and 1/2 inch wide. It can fire 12 of them in a second. It has no safety mechanism. The combination of Paulie and an NSV would be nobody's idea of fun.
But I think you swam. I can smell the sea on your shirt, very faintly. You didn't dry yourself properly when you got back.
We passed a sign for a town called Sauco. I coasted to the shoulder and stopped again. Cars and trucks whined past us.
You were incredibly lucky. There are some bad riptides off the point, strong undertow. But I expect you went in behind the garages, in which case you missed them by about 10 feet.
I don't work for the government.
Don't you?
Don't you think you're taking a hell of a chance? Let's say I wasn't exactly what I appeared to be, just for the sake of argument. Let's say I was from a rival organization, for instance. Don't you see the risk? You think you would make it back to the house alive, saying what you're saying? She looked away.
Then I guess that would be the test. If you're a government man, you won't kill me. If you're not, you will.
I'm just a guy. You could get me in trouble.
Let's find coffee, she said. Sauco is a nice town. All the big mill owners lived there way back.
We ended up on an island in the middle of the Sauco River. There was an enormous brick building on it that had been a gigantic mill way back in history. Now it was being gentrified into hundreds of offices and stores. We found a glass and chrome coffee shop called Café Café. A pun in French, I guessed. But the smell alone was worth the trip. I ignored the lattes and the flavored foamy stuff and ordered regular coffee, hot, black, large. Then I turned to Elizabeth Beck.
She shook her head. You stay. I've decided to go shopping. Alone. I'll meet you back here in 4 hours.
I said nothing.
I don't need your permission. You're just my driver.
I don't have any money.
She gave me $20 from her purse. I paid for the coffee and carried it to a table. She came with me and watched me sit down. 4 hours. Maybe a little more, but no less, in case there's something you need to do.
I've got nothing to do. I'm just your driver.
She looked at me, zipped her purse. The space around my table was tight. She twisted a little to get the strap of her purse square on her shoulder, jackknifed slightly to avoid touching the table and spilling my coffee. There was a clunk, like plastic hitting the floor. I looked down. Something had fallen out from under her skirt. She stared at it, and her face slowly turned a deep shade of red. She bent and picked the thing up and clutched it in her hand, fumbled her way onto the chair opposite me like all the strength had gone out of her, like she was utterly humiliated. She was holding a pager. It was a black, plastic rectangle, a little smaller than my own email device. She stared at it. Her neck was bright red all the way down under her sweater. She spoke in a low, rueful whisper. He makes me carry it there, inside my underpants. He likes it to have what he calls the appropriate effect when it buzzes. He checks that it's there every time I go through the gate. Normally I take it out and put it in my bag afterward, but I didn't want to do that, you know, this time with you watching.
I said nothing. She stood up, blinked twice, and took a breath and swallowed.
4 hours, in case there's something you need to do.
Then she walked away. I watched her go. She turned left outside the door and disappeared.
An elaborate con game?
It was possible that they could try to set me up with her story. Possible that she could carry a pager in her pants to back it up. Possible that she could contrive to shake it loose at exactly the right moment. All possible. But what wasn't even remotely possible was that she could manufacture a deep red blush right on cue. Nobody can do that. Not even the world's finest actress at the peak of her powers could do that. So Elizabeth Beck was for real.
I didn't abandon sensible precautions entirely. They were too deeply ingrained for that.
I finished my coffee like an innocent person with all the time in the world. Then I strolled out to the mall's internal sidewalks and turned random lefts and rights until I was sure I was alone. Then I went back to the coffee shop and bought another cup, borrowed their restroom key, and locked myself in. Sat on the lid of the John and took off my shoe. There was a message waiting from Duffy.
Why interest in Teresa Daniels' real name?
I ignored it and sent, "Where is your motel?" 90 seconds later, she answered, "What did you have for breakfast first day in Boston?"
I smiled. Duffy was a practical woman. She was worried my email device had been compromised. She was asking a security question.
I sent, "Short stack with egg, coffee, $3 tip.
I ate it. Any other answer than that, and she would be running for her car. 90 seconds later, she came back with, "West side of Route 1, 100 yards south of Kennebunk River." I figured that was about 10 miles away. I sent, "See you in 10 minutes." It took me more like 15 minutes by the time I had gotten back to the car and fought the traffic where Route 1 bottlenecked through Sauco. I kept one eye on the mirror the whole way and saw nothing to worry about. I crossed the river and found a motel on my right. It was a cheerful, bright gray place, pretending to be a string of classic New England salt boxes. It was April, and not very busy. I saw the Taurus I had been a passenger in out of Boston, parked next to the end room. It was the only plain sedan I could see. I put the Cadillac 30 yards away behind a wooden shed hiding a big propane tank. No sense in leaving it visible to everybody passing by on Route 1. I walked back and knocked once, and Susan Duffy opened the door fast, and we hugged. We just went straight into it. It took me completely by surprise. I think it took her by surprise, too. We probably wouldn't have done it if we had thought about it first. But I guess she was anxious, and I was stressed, and it just happened. And it felt real good. She was tall, but she was slight. My hand spanned almost the whole width of her back, and I felt her ribs give a little. She smelled fresh and clean. No perfume, just skin, not long out of the shower.
"What do you know about Teresa?" she asked.
"You alone?" She nodded.
"The others are in Portland. Customs says Beck's got a boat coming in today."
We let go of each other, moved on into the room. "What are they going to do?"
"Observation only. Don't worry, they're good at it. Nobody will see them."
It was a very generic motel room. One queen bed, a chair, a desk, a TV, a window, a through-the-wall air conditioner. The only things that distinguished it from 100,000 other motel rooms were a blue and gray color scheme and nautical prints on the wall. They gave it a definite New England coastal flavor.
"What do you know about Teresa?" she asked again.
I told her about the name carved into the basement room floor and the date. Duffy stared at me. Then she closed her eyes.
"She's alive. Thank you."
"But she was alive yesterday," I said. She opened her eyes.
"You think she's alive today?"
I nodded. "I think the odds are pretty good. They want her for something. Why keep her alive 9 weeks and kill her now?" Duffy said nothing. "I think they just moved her, that's all. That's my best guess. The door was locked in the morning. She was gone by the evening."
"You think she's been treated okay?"
I didn't tell her what Paulie liked to do with Elizabeth Beck. She already had enough to worry about. "I think she scratched her name with a fork," I said. "And there was a spare plate of steak and potatoes lying around last night. Like they took her out in such a hurry they forgot to tell the cook. So I think they were probably feeding her. I think she's a prisoner, plain and simple."
"Where would they have taken her?"
"I think Quinn's got her."
"Why?"
"Because it seems to me what we're looking at here is one organization superimposed over another. Beck's a bad guy, for sure, but he's been taken over by a worse guy."
"Like a corporate thing?"
"Exactly. Like a hostile takeover. Quinn's put his staff into Beck's operation. He's riding it like a parasite."
"But why would they move Teresa?"
"Precaution."
"Because of you? How worried are they?"
"A little. I think they're moving things and hiding things."
"But they haven't confronted you yet."
I nodded. "They're not really sure about me."
"So why are they taking a risk with you?"
"Because I saved the boy." She nodded, went quiet. She looked a little tired. I guessed maybe she hadn't slept at all since I asked her for the car at midnight. She was wearing jeans and a man's Oxford shirt. The shirt was pure white and neatly tucked in. The top two buttons were undone. She was wearing boat shoes over bare feet. The room heat was set on high. There was a laptop computer on the desk next to the room phone. The phone was a console thing, all covered in fast-dial buttons. I checked the number and memorized it.
The laptop was plugged through a complex adapter into a data port built into the base of the phone. There was a screensaver playing on it. It showed the Justice Department shield drifting around. Every time it reached the edge of the screen, it would bounce off in a new random direction, like that ancient video tennis game. There was no sound with it.
Have you seen Quinn yet?
I shook my head.
Know where he operates out of?
I shook my head again. I haven't really seen anything, except their books are coded, and they don't have enough of a distribution fleet to be moving what they seem to move. Maybe their customers collect.
That would be insane. They wouldn't show their customers their base of operations. In fact, we already know they don't. Beck met with the L.A. dealer in a parking garage, remember?
So maybe they rendezvous somewhere neutral for the actual sales, somewhere close by in the Northeast. She nodded.
How did you see their books?
I was in their office last night. That's why I wanted the car. She moved to the desk and sat down and tapped the laptop's touchpad. The screensaver disappeared. My last email was displayed under it. See you in 10 minutes. She went into the deleted items directory and clicked on a message from Powell, the MP who had sold me out.
We traced those names for you, she said. Angel Dahl did 8 years in Leavenworth for sexual assault. Should have been life for rape and murder, but the prosecution screwed up. He was a communications technician. Raped a female lieutenant colonel, left her to bleed to death from the inside. He's not a very nice guy.
He's a very dead guy. She just looked at me. He checked the Maximus plates, confronted me. Big error. He was the first casualty.
You killed him?
Broke his neck. She said nothing. His choice. He was about to compromise the mission. She was pale. You okay? She looked away.
I wasn't really expecting casualties.
There might be more. Get used to it. She looked back at me, took a breath, nodded.
Okay. Sorry about the plates. That was a mistake.
Anything about Paulie? She scrolled down the screen.
Dahl had a buddy in Leavenworth called Paul Massarella, a bodybuilder serving 8 for assault on an officer. His defense counsel pleaded it down on account of steroid rage, tried to blame the Army for not monitoring Massarella's intake.
His intake is all over the place now.
You think he's the same, Paulie?
Must be. He told me he doesn't like officers. I kicked him in the kidney. It would have killed you or Elliot. He didn't even notice.
What's he going to do about it?
I hate to think.
You okay with going back?
Beck's wife knows I'm phony.
She stared at me. How?
I shrugged. Maybe she doesn't know. Maybe she just wants me to be. Maybe she's trying to convince herself.
Is she broadcasting it?
Not yet. She saw me out of the house last night.
You can't go back.
I'm not a quitter.
You're not an idiot either. It's out of control now.
I nodded. But it's my decision.
She shook her head. It's our decision, jointly. You're depending on our backup.
We need to get Teresa out of there. We really do, Duffy. It's a hell of a situation for her to be in.
I could send SWAT teams for her, now you've confirmed she's alive.
We don't know where she is right now.
She's my responsibility.
And Quinn is mine. She said nothing. You can't send SWAT teams. You're off the books. Asking for SWAT teams is the same thing as asking to be fired.
I'm prepared to get fired, if it comes to it.
It's not just you. 6 other guys would get fired with you. She said nothing. And I'm going back anyway, because I want Quinn. With you or without you. So you might as well use me.
What did Quinn do to you?
I said nothing. She was quiet for a long moment.
Would Mrs. Beck talk to us? She said.
I don't want to ask her. Asking her is the same thing as confirming her suspicions. I can't be sure exactly where that would lead.
What would you do if you went back?
Get promoted. That's the key. I need to move up into Duke's job. Then I'll be top boy on Beck's side. Then I'll get some kind of official liaison with Quinside. That's what I need. I'm working in the dark without it.
We need progress, she said. We need evidence.
I know.
How will you get promoted?
Same way anybody gets promoted. She didn't reply to that, just switched her email program back to inbox and stood up and stepped away to the window to look at the view. I looked at her. The light behind her was coming right through her shirt. Her hair was swept back, and a couple of inches of it was on her collar. It looked like a $500 style to me, but I guessed on a DEA salary she probably did it herself, or got a girlfriend to do it for her. I could picture her in someone's kitchen, on a chair set out in the middle of the floor, an old towel around her neck, interested in how she looked, but not interested enough to spend big bucks in a city salon. Her butt looked spectacular in the jeans. I could see the label on the back. Waist 24, leg 32. That made her in seem 5 inches short of mine, which I was prepared to accept. But a waist a whole foot smaller than mine was ridiculous. I carry almost no body fat. All I've got in there are the necessary organs, tight and dense. She must have had miniature versions. I see a waist like that, and all I want to do is span it with my hands and marvel at it. Maybe bury my head somewhere, a little higher up. I couldn't tell what that might feel like with her, unless she turned around. But I suspected it might feel very nice indeed.
How dangerous is it now? She asked. Realistic assessment.
Can't tell. Too many variables. Mrs. Beck is running on intuition, that's all. Maybe a little wish fulfillment with it. She's got no hard evidence. In terms of hard evidence, I think I'm holding up okay. So even if Mrs. Beck talks to somebody, it all depends on whether they choose to take a woman's intuition seriously or not.
She saw you out of the house. That's hard evidence.
But of what? That I'm restless?
This guy Dahl was killed while you weren't locked up.
They'll assume I didn't get past the wall, and they won't find Dahl. No way. Not in time.
Why did they move Teresa?
Precaution.
It's out of control now.
I shrugged, even though she couldn't see the gesture. This kind of thing is always out of control. It's to be expected. Nothing ever works like you predicted. All plans fall apart as soon as the first shot is fired.
She went quiet, turned around. What are you going to do now?
I paused a beat. The light was still behind her.
Very nice indeed.
I'm going to take a nap.
How long have you got?
I checked my watch. About 3 hours.
You tired?
I nodded. I was up all night, swimming mostly.
You swam past the wall?
Maybe you are an idiot. Are you tired too?
Very. I've been working hard for weeks.
So take a nap with me.
Doesn't feel right. Teresa's in danger somewhere.
I can't go yet, anyway. Not until Mrs. Beck is ready.
She paused a beat. There's only one bed.
Not a huge problem. You're thin. You won't take up much room.
Wouldn't be right.
We don't have to get in. We could just lie on top.
Right next to each other?
Fully dressed. I'll even keep my shoes on.
She said nothing.
It's not against the law.
Maybe it is. Some states have weird old statutes. Maine might be one of them.
I've got other Maine statutes to worry about.
Not right this minute.
I smiled. Then I yawned. I sat on the bed and lay down on my back. Rolled over on my side and turned away from the middle and jammed my arms up under my head. Closed my eyes. I sensed her standing there. Minute after minute. Then I felt her lie down next to me. She shuffled around a little. Then she went still. But she was tense. I could feel it. It was coming through the mattress springs, tiny, high-frequency thrills of concern.
Don't panic, I said. I'm way too tired. But I wasn't.
Really. The problem started when she moved slightly and touched my butt with hers. It was a very faint contact, but she might as well have plugged me into a power outlet. I opened my eyes and stared at the wall and tried to figure out whether she was asleep and had moved involuntarily, or whether she had done it on purpose. I spent a couple of minutes thinking it through. But I guess mortal danger is an aphrodisiac, because I found myself erring on the side of optimism. Then I wasn't certain about the required response. What was the correct etiquette? I settled for moving an inch myself and firming up the connection. I figured that would put the ball back in her court. Now she could struggle with the interpretation. Nothing happened for a whole minute. I was on the point of getting disappointed when she moved again. Now the connection was pretty damn solid. If I didn't weigh 250 pounds, she might have slid me right across the shiny bed cover. I was fairly certain I could feel the rivets on her back pockets. My turn. I disguised it with a sort of sleepy sound and rolled over so we were stacked like spoons, and my arm was accidentally touching her shoulder. Her hair was in my face. It was soft and smelled like summer. The cotton of her shirt was crisp. It plunged down to her waist, and then the denim of her jeans swooped back up over her hips. I squinted down. She had taken her shoes off. I could see the soles of her feet. 10 little toes, all in a line. She made a sleepy sound of her own. I was pretty sure it was fake. She nestled backward until she was jammed tight against me from top to bottom. I put my hand on her upper arm. Then I moved it down until it fell off her elbow and came to rest on her waist. The tip of my little finger was under the waistband of her jeans. She made another sound, almost certainly a fake. I held my breath. Her butt was tight against my groin. My heart was thumping. My head was spinning. No way could I resist. No way at all. It was one of those insane, hormone-driven moments when I would have risked 8 years in Leavenworth for it. I slid my hand up and forward and cupped her breast. After that, things got completely out of control. She was one of those women who is far more attractive naked than clothed. Not all women are, but she was. She had a body to die for. She had no tan, but her skin was not pale. It was as soft as silk, but it was not translucent. She was very slim, but I couldn't see her bones. She was long and she was lean. She was made for one of those bathing suits that swoop way up at the sides. She had small, firm breasts, perfectly shaped. Her neck was long and slender. She had great ears and ankles and knees and shoulders. She had a little hollow at the base of her throat. It was very slightly damp. She was strong, too. I must have outweighed her by 130 pounds, but she had worn me out. She was young, I guess. She had maybe 10 years on me. She had left me exhausted, which made her smile. She had a great smile. "Remember my hotel room in Boston?" I said. "The way you sat on the chair? I wanted you right then."
"I was just sitting on a chair. There wasn't a way to it."
"Don't kid yourself.
Remember the Freedom Trail? You told me about the long rod penetrator. I wanted you right then."
I smiled. "It was part of a $1 billion defense contract," I said. "So I'm glad this particular citizen got something out of it."
"If Elliot hadn't been with me, I'd have done it right there in the park."
"There was a woman feeding the birds."
"We could have gone behind a bush.
Paul Revere would have seen us."
"He rode all night."
"I'm not Paul Revere."
She smiled again. I felt it against my shoulder. "All done, old guy?"
"I didn't say that exactly."
"Danger is an aphrodisiac, isn't it?"
"I guess it is."
"So you admit you're in danger?"
"I'm in danger of having a heart attack."
"You really shouldn't go back."
"I'm in danger of not being able to."
She sat up on the bed. Gravity had no effect on her perfection. "I'm serious, Reacher."
I smiled up at her. "I'll be okay. 2 or 3 more days. I'll find Teresa, and I'll find Quinn, and then I'll get out."
"Only if I let you."
I nodded. "The 2 bodyguards," I said. She nodded in turn.
That's why you need my end of the operation. You can forget all about the heroic stuff. With you or without you, my ass. We turn those guys loose and you're a dead man, one phone call later.
Where are they now?
In the first motel, back in Massachusetts, where we made the plans. The guys from the Toyota and the college car are sitting on them.
Hard, I hope.
Very.
That's hours away.
By road, not by telephone.
You want Teresa back?
Yes, but I'm in charge.
You're a control freak.
I don't want anything bad to happen to you, is all.
Nothing bad ever happens to me. She leaned down and traced her fingertips over the scars on my body. Chest, stomach, arms, shoulders, forehead.
You've taken a lot of damage for a guy nothing bad ever happens to.
I'm clumsy. I fall over a lot.
She stood up and walked to the bathroom, naked, graceful, completely unself-conscious.
Hurry back, I called.
But she didn't hurry back. She was in the bathroom a long time, and when she came out again, she was wearing a robe. Her face had changed. She looked a little awkward, a little rueful.
We shouldn't have done that.
Why not?
It was unprofessional.
She looked straight at me. I nodded. I guessed it was a little unprofessional.
But it was fun, I said.
We shouldn't have.
We're grown-ups. We live in a free country.
It was just taking comfort, because we're both stressed and uptight.
Nothing really wrong with that.
It's going to complicate things.
I shook my head.
Not if we don't let it. Doesn't mean we have to get married or anything. We don't owe each other anything because of it.
I wish we hadn't.
I'm glad we did. I think if a thing feels right, you should do it.
That's your philosophy?
I looked away. It's the voice of experience. I once said no when I wanted to say yes, and I lived to regret it.
She hugged the robe tight around her. It did feel good.
For me, too.
But we should forget it now. It meant what it meant, nothing more, okay?
Okay.
And you should think hard about going back.
Okay, I said again.
I lay on the bed and thought about how it felt to say no when you really wanted to say yes. On balance, saying yes had been better, and I had no regrets.
Duffy was quiet. It was like we were just waiting for something to happen.
I took a long hot shower and dressed in the bathroom. We were done talking by then. There was nothing left to say. We both knew I was going back. I liked the fact that she didn't really try to stop me. I liked the fact that we were both focused, practical people. I was lacing my shoes when her laptop went ping, like a muffled, high-pitched bell, like a microwave when your food is ready. No artificial voice saying, "You've got mail." I came out of the bathroom, and she sat down in front of the computer and clicked the button.
Message from my office. Records show 11 dubious ex-cops called Duke. I put the request in yesterday. How old is he?
40, maybe.
She scrolled through her list.
Southern guy? Northern?
Not Southern.
Choice of three.
Mrs. Beck said he'd been a federal agent, too. She scrolled some more.
John Chapman, Duke. He's the only one who went federal afterward. Started in Minneapolis as a patrolman and then a detective. Subject of three investigations by Internal Affairs. Inconclusive. Then he joined us.
DEA? Really?
No, I meant the federal government. He went to the Treasury Department.
To do what?
Doesn't say. But he was indicted within 3 years. Some kind of corruption, plus suspicion of multiple homicides. No real hard evidence. But he went to prison for 4 years anyway.
Description?
White, about your size. The photo makes him look uglier, though.
That's him.
She scrolled some more, read the rest of the report.
Take care. He sounds like a piece of work.
Don't worry, I said.
I thought about kissing her goodbye at the door, but I didn't. I figured she wouldn't want me to. I just ran over to the Cadillac.
I was back in the coffee shop and almost at the end of my second cup when Elizabeth Beck appeared. She had nothing to show for her shopping. No purchases, no gaudy bags. I guessed she hadn't actually been inside any stores. She had hung around for 4 long hours to let the government guy do whatever he needed to. I raised my hand. She ignored me and headed straight for the counter, bought herself a tall white coffee and carried it over to my table. I decided what I was going to tell her. "I don't work for the government," I said.
"Then I'm disappointed," she said,
for the third time. "How could I? I killed a cop, remember?"
"Yes."
"Government people don't do stuff like that."
"They might, by accident."
"But they wouldn't run away afterward. They would stick around and face the music." She went quiet and stayed quiet for a long time, sipped her coffee slowly.
"I've been there maybe 8 or 10 times. Where the college is, I mean. They run events for the students' families now and then, and I try to be there at the start and finish of every semester. One summer, I even rented a little U-Haul and helped him move his stuff home."
"So?"
"It's a small school. But even so, on the first day of the semester, it gets very busy. Lots of parents, lots of students, SUVs, cars, vans, traffic everywhere. The family days are even worse. And you know what?"
"What?"
"I've never seen a town policeman there. Not once. Certainly not a detective in plain clothes."
I looked out the window to the internal mall sidewalk.
"Just a coincidence, I suppose. A random Tuesday morning in April, early in the day, nothing much going on, and there's a detective waiting right by the gate, for no obvious reason."
"What's your point?"
"That you were terribly unlucky. I mean, what were the odds?"
"I don't work for the government."
"You took a shower, washed your hair."
"Did I?"
"I can see it and smell it. Cheap soap, cheap shampoo."
"I went to a sauna."
"You didn't have any money. I gave you $20. You bought at least 2 cups of coffee. That would leave maybe $14.
"It was a cheap sauna."
"It must have been."
"I'm just a guy."
"And I'm disappointed about it."
"You sound like you want your husband to get busted."
"I do."
"He'd go to prison."
"He already lives in a prison, and he deserves to. But he'd be freer in a real prison than where he is now, and he wouldn't be there forever."
"You could call somebody. You don't need to wait for them to come to you."
She shook her head. "That would be suicide, for me and Richard."
"Just like it would be if you talked about me like this in front of anybody else. Remember, I wouldn't go quietly. People would get hurt. You and Richard, maybe."
She smiled. "Bargaining with me again?"
"Warning you again. Full disclosure."
She nodded. "I know how to keep my mouth shut," she said.
And then she proved it by not saying another word. We finished our coffee in silence and walked back to the car. We didn't talk. I drove her home, north and east, completely unsure whether I was carrying a ticking time bomb with me or turning my back on the only inside help I would ever get. Paulie was waiting behind the gate. He must have been watching from his window and then taken up position as soon as he saw the car in the distance. I slowed and stopped, and he stared out at me. Then he stared at Elizabeth Beck. "Give me the pager," I said.
"I can't."
"Just do it." Paulie unlatched the chain and pushed the gate. Elizabeth unzipped her bag and handed me the pager. I let the car roll forward and buzzed my window down, stopped level with where Paulie was waiting to shut the gate again. "Check this out," I called. I tossed the pager overarm out in front of the car. It was a left-handed throw. It was weak and lacked finesse, but it got the job done. The little black plastic rectangle looped up in the air and landed dead center on the driveway, maybe 20 feet in front of the car. Paulie watched its trajectory and then froze when he realized what it was. "Hey," he said. He went after it. I went after him. I stamped on the gas, and the tires howled, and the car jumped forward. I aimed the right-hand corner of the front bumper at the side of his left knee. I got very close, but he was incredibly quick. He scooped the pager off the blacktop and skipped back, and I missed him by a foot. The car shot straight past him. I didn't slow down, just accelerated away and watched him in the mirror, standing in my wake, staring after me, blue tire smoke drifting all around him. I was severely disappointed. If I had to fight a guy who outweighed me by 200 pounds, I'd have been much happier if he was crippled first, or at least if he wasn't so damn fast. I stopped on the carriage circle and let Elizabeth back out at the front door. Then I put the car away and was heading for the kitchen when Zachary Beck and John Chapman Duke came out looking for me. They were agitated and walking quickly. They were tense and upset. I thought they were going to give me a hard time about Paulie, but they weren't.
"Angel Doll is missing," Beck said.
I stood still. The wind was blowing in off the ocean. The lazy swell was gone, and the waves were as big and noisy as they had been on the first evening. There was spray in the air.
"He spoke with you last thing," Beck said. "Then he locked up and left, and he hasn't been seen since."
"What did he want with you?" Duke said. "I don't know," I said.
"You don't know? You were in there 5 minutes."
I nodded. "He took me back to the warehouse office."
"And?"
"And nothing. He was all set to say something, but his cell phone rang."
"Who was it?"
I shrugged. "How would I know? Some kind of an urgent thing. He talked on the phone the whole 5 minutes. He was wasting my time and yours, so I just gave it up and walked back out."
"What was he saying on the phone?"
I didn't listen. Didn't seem polite.
"Hear any names?"
Beck asked. I turned to him, shook my head. No names, but they knew each other. That was clear. Dahl did a lot of listening, I guess. I think he was taking instructions about something.
About what?
No idea.
Something urgent?
I guess so. He seemed to forget all about me. Certainly he didn't try to stop me when I walked away.
That's all you know?
I assumed it was some kind of a plan. Instructions for the following day, maybe.
Today?
I shrugged again. I'm just guessing. It was a very one-sided conversation.
"Terrific," Duke said. "You're a real big help, you know that?"
Beck looked out at the ocean.
"So he took an urgent call on his cell, and then he locked up and left. That's all you can tell us?"
"I didn't see him lock up, and I didn't see him leave. He was still on the phone when I came out."
"Obviously he locked up," Beck said. "And obviously he left. Everything was perfectly normal this morning."
I said nothing. Beck turned through 90 degrees and faced east. The wind came off the sea and flattened his clothes against him. His trouser legs flapped like flags. He moved his feet, scuffing the soles of his shoes against the grit like he was trying to get warm.
"We don't need this now. We really don't need this. We've got a big weekend coming up."
I said nothing. They turned around together and headed back to the house and left me there alone. I was tired, but I wasn't going to get any rest, that was clear. There was bustle in the air, and the routine I had seen on the previous 2 nights was all shot to hell. There was no food in the kitchen, no dinner. The cook wasn't there. I heard people moving in the hallway. Duke came into the kitchen and walked straight past me and went out the back door. He was carrying a blue Nike sports bag. I followed him out and stood and watched from the corner of the house and saw him go into the second garage. 5 minutes later, he backed the black Lincoln out and drove off in it. He had changed the plates. When I had seen it in the middle of the night, it had 6-digit main plates on it. Now it was showing a 7-digit New York number. I went back inside and looked for coffee. I found the machine, but I couldn't find any filter papers. I settled for a glass of water instead. I was halfway through drinking it when Beck came in. He was carrying a sports bag, too. The way it hung from its handles and the noise it made when it bumped against his leg told me it was full of heavy metal. Guns, probably. Maybe 2 of them.
"Get the Cadillac. Right now. Pick me up at the front."
He took the keys out of his pocket and dropped them on the table in front of me. Then he crouched down and unzipped his bag and came out with 2 New York license plates and a screwdriver, handed them to me.
"Put these on it first."
I saw guns in the bag. 2 Heckler & Koch MP5Ks, short and fat and black, with big, bulbous, molded handles. Futuristic, like movie props.
"Where are we going?"
We're following Duke down to Hartford, Connecticut. We've got some business there, remember?
He zipped the bag and stood up and carried it back out into the hallway. I sat still for a second. Then I raised my glass of water and toasted the blank wall in front of me.
Here's to bloody wars and dread diseases, I said to myself.
Chapter 7. I left the rest of the water in the kitchen and headed out toward the garage block. Dusk was gathering on the ocean horizon, 100 miles away in the east. The wind was blowing hard, and the waves were pounding. I stopped walking and turned a casual circle. Saw nobody else out and about. So I ducked out of sight down the side of the courtyard wall, found my hidden bundle and laid the phony plates and the screwdriver on the rocks and unwrapped both guns. Duffy's Glock went into my right-hand coat pocket. Dahl's PSM went into my left. I put the spare Glock mags in my socks, stowed the rag and picked up the plates and the screwdriver, and backtracked to the courtyard entrance. The mechanic was busy in the third garage, the empty one. He had the doors wide open and was oiling the hinges. The space behind him was even cleaner than when I had seen it in the night. It was immaculate. The floor had been hosed. I could see it drying in patches. I nodded to the guy, and he nodded back. I opened up the left-hand garage, squatted down and unscrewed the main plate off the Cadillac's trunk lid, and replaced it with the New York number. Did the same at the front. Left the old plates and the screwdriver on the floor, and got in and fired it up. Backed it out, and headed around to the carriage circle. The mechanic watched me go. Beck was waiting there for me. He opened the rear door himself, and dropped his sports bag on the back seat. I heard the guns shifting inside. Then he closed the rear door again and slid in the front beside me.
Go. Use I-95 south as far as Boston.
We need gas.
Okay, first place you see.
Paulie was waiting at the gate. His face was all twisted up with anger. He was a problem that wouldn't keep much longer. He glared in at me, turned his head left and right, and kept his eyes on me the whole time he was opening the gate. I ignored him and drove on through. I didn't look back at him. Out of sight, out of mind, was the way I wanted to play it, as far as he was concerned. The coast road west was empty. We were on the highway 12 minutes after we left the house. I was getting used to the way the Cadillac drove. It was a nice car, smooth and quiet, but it was heavy on gas, that was for sure. The needle was getting seriously low. I could almost see it moving. The way I recalled it, the first gas stop was the one south of Kennebunk, the place where I had met with Duffy and Elliot on the way down to New London. We reached it within 15 minutes. It felt very familiar to me. I drove past the parking lot where we had broken into the van and headed down to the pumps. Beck said nothing. I got out and filled the tank. It took a long time, 18 gallons. I screwed the cap back on, and Beck buzzed his window down and gave me a wad of cash.
"Always buy gas with cash," he said. "Safer that way."
I kept the change, which was a little over $15. I figured I was entitled. I hadn't been paid yet. I got back on the road and settled in for the trip. I was tired. Nothing worse than mile after mile of lonely highway when you're tired. Beck was quiet beside me. At first, I thought he was just morose, or shy, or inhibited. Then I realized he was nervous. I guessed he wasn't entirely comfortable heading into battle. I was, especially because I knew for sure we weren't going to find anybody to fight. "How's Richard?" I asked him.
"He's fine. He's got inner strength. He's a good son."
"Is he?" I said, because I needed to say something. I needed him to talk, to keep me awake.
"He's very loyal. A father can't ask for more."
Then he went quiet again, and I fought to stay awake. 5 miles. 10.
"Have you ever dealt with small-time dope dealers?" he asked me.
"No."
"There's something unique about them."
He didn't say anything more for 20 miles. Then he picked it up again like he had spent the entire time chasing an elusive thought.
"They're completely dominated by fashion," he said.
"Are they?" I said, like I was interested. I wasn't, but I still needed him to talk.
Of course, lab jugs are fashion items anyway. Really, their customers are just as bad as they are. I can't even keep track of the stuff they sell. Some different, weird name every week.
What's a lab drug?
A jug made in a lab. You know, something manufactured, something chemical. Not the same as something that grows naturally in the ground.
Like marijuana.
Or heroin. Or cocaine. Those are natural products, organic. They're refined, obviously, but they aren't created in a beaker.
I said nothing, just fought to keep my eyes open. The car was way too warm. You need cold air when you're tired. I bit my bottom lip to stay awake.
The fashion thing infects everything they do. Every single thing. Shoes, for instance. These guys we're looking for tonight, every time I've seen them, they've had different shoes.
What, like sneakers?
Sure, like they play basketball for a living. One time they got $200 Reeboks, brand new out of the box. Next time I see them, Reeboks are completely unacceptable, and it's got to be Nikes or something. Air this, air that. Or it's suddenly Caterpillar boots or Timberlands. Leather, then Gore-Tex, then leather again. Black, then that yellow color like a work boot. Always with the laces undone. Then it's back to the running shoes again, only this time it's Adidas with the little stripes. $200-$300 a pop. For no reason. It's insane.
I said nothing, just drove with my eyelids locked open and my eyeballs stinging.
You know why it is? Because of the money. They've got so much money, they don't know what to do with it. Like jackets. Have you seen the jackets they wear?
One week, it's gotta be North Face, all shiny and puffy, full of goose feathers. Doesn't matter whether it's winter or summer, because these guys are only out at night. The next week, shiny is yesterday's news. Maybe North Face is still okay, but now it's got to be microfiber. Then it's leather jackets, wool with leather sleeves. $200-$300 a pop. Each style lasts about a week.
Crazy, I said, because I had to say something.
That's the money. They don't know what to do with it. So they get into change for change's sake. It infects everything. Guns, too, of course. Like these particular guys. They liked Heckler & Koch MP5Ks. Now they have Uzis, according to you. You see what I mean? With these guys, even their weapons are fashion items, the same as their sneakers or their jackets, or their actual product, which brings everything full circle. Their demands change all the time, in every arena, cars, even. They like Japanese, mostly, which is about fashions coming in from the West Coast, I guess. But one week it's Toyotas, next week it's Hondas, then it's Nissans. The Nissan Maxima was a big favorite 2-3 years ago, like the one you stole. Then it's Lexuses. It's a mania. Their watches, too. Huh. They're wearing Swatches, then they're wearing Rolexes. They don't see a difference. Complete madness. Of course, being in the market, speaking as a supplier, I'm not complaining. Market obsolescence is what we aim for, but it gets a little rapid at times. Gets hard to keep up.
So you're in the market.
What's your guess? You thought I was an accountant?
I thought you were a rug importer.
I am. I import a lot of rugs.
Okay.
But that's fundamentally a cover. You think you don't have to take precautions these days, selling athletic shoes to people like that?
He kept on laughing. There was a lot of nervous tension in there. I drove on. He calmed down. Looked through the side window, looked through the windshield. Started talking again, like it served his own purpose as much as it served mine.
You ever wear sneakers?
No.
Because I'm looking for somebody to explain it to me. There's no rational difference between a Reebok and a Nike, is there?
I wouldn't know.
I mean, they're probably made in the same factory, out in Vietnam somewhere. They're probably the same shoe until they put the logo on.
Maybe. I really wouldn't know. I was never an athlete, never wore that type of footwear.
Is there a difference between a Toyota and a Honda?
I wouldn't know.
Why not?
Because I never had a POV.
What's a POV?
privately owned vehicle. What the army would call a Toyota or a Honda, or a Nissan or a Lexus.
So what do you know?
I know the difference between a Swatch and a Rolex.
Okay. What's the difference?
There isn't one. They both tell the time.
That's no answer.
I know the difference between an Uzi and a Heckler & Koch. He turned on his seat.
Good. Great. Explain it to me. Why would these guys junk their Heckler & Kochs in favor of Uzis?
The Cadillac hummed onward. I shrugged at the wheel, fought a yawn. It was a nonsense question, of course. The Hartford guys hadn't junked their MP5Ks in favor of Uzis. Not in reality. Elliot and Duffy hadn't been aware of Hartford's weapon du jour, and they hadn't been aware that Beck knew anything about Hartford, that's all. So they had given their guys Uzis, probably because they were lying around closest to hand. But theoretically, it was a very good question. An Uzi is a fine, fine weapon. A little heavy, maybe. Not the world's fastest cyclic rate, which might matter to some people. Not much rifling inside the barrel, which compromises accuracy a little bit. On the other hand, it's very reliable, very simple, totally proven, and you can get a 40-round magazine for it. A fine weapon. But any Heckler & Koch MP5 derivative is a better weapon. They fire the same ammunition faster and harder. They're very, very accurate. As accurate as a good rifle, in some hands. Very reliable. Flat out, better. A great 1970s design up against a great 1950s design. Doesn't hold true in all fields, but with military ordnance, modern is better. Every time. There's no reason, I said. Makes no sense to me.
Exactly. It's about fashion. It's an arbitrary whim. It's a compulsion. Keeps everybody in business, but drives everybody nuts, too.
His cell phone rang. He juggled it up out of his pocket and answered it by saying his name, short and sharp, and a little nervously.
Beck.
It sounded like a cough. He listened for a long time, made his call to repeat an address and directions, and then clicked off and put the phone back in his pocket.
That was Duke. He made some calls. Our boys aren't anywhere in Hartford, but they're supposed to have some country place a little ways south and east. Duke figures that's where they're holed up, so that's where we're going.
What are we going to do when we get there?
Nothing spectacular. We don't need to make a big deal out of it. Nothing neat, nothing fancy. Situation like this, I favor just mowing them down. An impression of inevitability, you know? But casual. Like, you mess with me, then punishment is definitely swift and certain. But not like I'm in a sweat about it.
You lose customers that way.
I can replace them. I've got people lining up around the block. That's the truly great thing about this business. Supply and demand is tilted way in favor of demand.
You gonna do this yourself? He shook his head.
That's what you and Duke are for.
Me? I thought I was just driving.
He already wasted two of them. A couple more shouldn't bother you.
I turned the heater down a click and worked on keeping my eyes open. Bloody wars, I said to myself. We looped halfway around Boston, and then he told me to strike out south and west on the Mass Pike, and then I-84. We did 60 more miles, which took about an hour. He didn't want me to drive too fast. He didn't want to be conspicuous. Phony plates, a bag full of automatic weapons on the back seat, he didn't want the highway patrol to get involved. I could see the sense in that. I drove like an automaton. I hadn't slept in 40 hours. But I wasn't regretting passing up the chance of a nap in Duffy's motel. I was very happy with the way I had spent my time there, even if she wasn't.
Next exit, he said.
Right then, I-84 was spearing straight through the city of Hartford. There was low cloud, and the city lights made it orange. The exit led to a wide road that narrowed after a mile and headed south and east into open country. There was blackness ahead. There were a few closed country stores, bait and tackle, beer on ice, motorcycle parts, and then nothing at all except the dark shape of trees.
Make the next right,
he said, 8 minutes later. I turned onto a smaller road. The surface was bad, and there were random curves, dark